with medical experts from Mayo Clinic, Johns Hopkins, the Cleveland Clinic, and more, this is Med Clinic Radio.
Med Clinic Radio.
Exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you. Here's your host, Gina Tedesco.
Experts say one-fifth to one-half of patients with schizophrenia who show severe symptoms don't respond to medication. We'll talk with a researcher from Johns Hopkins Medicine, a pioneer in a fascinating approach for this ailment using deep brain stimulation. And Mayo Clinic develops a futuristic device, an implantable mechanical pump that helps pump blood from the lower chambers of the heart. We'll learn about the life-changing results for people who have weakened hearts or heart failure. That's all coming up on this week's Med Clinic Radio. We'll get started in just a moment.
Welcome back to Med Clinic Radio. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
It's been called one of the most disabling diseases affecting humans. Schizophrenia affects about 2.5 million Americans age 18 and older. It can cause hallucinations, delusions, thought and movement disorders, trouble focusing or paying attention, and a reduced ability to use information immediately after receiving it. Sadly, 20 to 50% of those who show severe symptoms are resistant to treatment. But now, recent research into deep brain stimulation offers hope to this group. Joining us is Dr. Nicola Cascella, Assistant Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and faculty member at the Johns Hopkins Schizophrenia Center. Doctor, although the research into this is still early, if the results you're seeing hold up, can you characterize the importance of this?
Yes, actually. You know, the favorable results that we have found in this initial case opens the way of hope, I would say, to a number of patients who actually have poorly responded to the current available treatments. So far, we can say that the most powerful medication that we use for treatment of those patients who usually do not respond to the antipsychotic medications is called clozapine. And there is a subgroup of patients who actually are treatment resistant even to clozapine, like in the case of our patient. So our treatment, the game changer, indeed applies to this subgroup of patients. And we hope actually to offer hope to these patients as we do more of them and clearly show that the treatment that we can offer to these patients is the treatment of choice.
And this deep brain stimulation has been effective in treating other conditions?
It has, actually. It was firstly introduced in the treatment of movement disorders, mainly Parkinson's disease. And those were patients, like in our case, for example, who were resistant to the treatment with medications like L-DOPA, for example, and they were clearly responding to the stimulation of certain parts of the brain that control movements. Later on, the application of deep brain stimulation has been expanded to the treatment of major depression, once again resistant to treatment, and obsessive-compulsive disorders.
Now, let's start by describing the patient you treated, her age, and her symptoms before you treated her.
Yes. The patient that we treated, actually, she reached us through going online and looking for a new form of treatments for her condition. And our trial is actually still registered with the FDA. She was able to contact us, and she was screened, and she appeared to meet criteria for entering into the study. She's a 35-year-old Caucasian woman with the onset of her illness at age 19. Since that age, she has had chronic hallucinations as well as delusions of persecutory content. She also had several suicide attempts because of the severity of the auditory hallucinations. She did trials with several medications. She was unable to tolerate clozapine, although even to that medication, the response was partial, but she gained an enormous amount of weight and she had discontinued that medication.
We're visiting with Dr. Nicola Cascella, Assistant Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, regarding a study into a possible treatment for those with schizophrenia who don't respond to existing drug therapies. Doctor, you focused on the substantia nigra pars reticulata, and your study says you modulate this area of the brain using deep brain stimulation. Now, does the stimulation treat a problem with the substantia nigra pars reticulata itself, or is that just an area of the brain that's sort of a logical access point to deliver treatment?
Yes, as you said, that's the port of entry. I mean, the substantia nigra pars reticulata is part of a kind of loop of brain areas that are involved in controlling movements as well as affect, emotions, and thinking. So we thought that by modulating this area, we would eventually affect down the road a part of the brain called mediodorsal nucleus of the thalamus. And from there, usually the mediodorsal nucleus of the thalamus sends projections to different cortical areas, including in the part of the brain that is potentially involved with the auditory verbal hallucinations.
So you mentioned the ganglia and the thalamus. Exactly, though, what does the stimulation do, or what process does it set in motion?
Well, I mean, the specifics are not well known yet, but as you already said, we tend to modulate, so to, in a way, alter, if you want, the electrical activity in that part of the brain. And by doing that, we think, at least based on our results, that we can treat the symptoms of the illness that poorly respond to the medications.
Up next on MedClinic Radio, we'll describe the favorable results from this study. Back in a moment.
Let's return to MedClinic Radio with your host, Gina Tedesco.
We're back now with Dr. Nicola Cascella, Assistant Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. He studied an innovative technique to fight severe schizophrenia symptoms that do not respond to treatment. The study is published in the journal Biological Psychiatry. Doctor, how did you deliver the deep brain stimulation?
Yes, there is essentially, it's an invasive procedure, of course. What is interesting is that before we go into some details for how we deliver the electrical current or the stimulus to the brain, we were very careful in the way we chose the patients. We made sure that, of course, the patient had the capacity to consent to such treatment, and the assessment of her capacity was done by a psychiatrist who was independent of the treatment team. And she was deemed to be competent to make this type of choice. We made sure also that the patient had an intact support system behind her. So we, of course, don't want to implant patients who maybe are homeless or do not have a family structure or other support system behind them. And she had a very intact family of parents around her that were very supportive of the patient as well as of her choice to receive this type of treatment. Once we did that, of course, we did, for protocol reasons, hospitalize the patient for about a week before the surgery on the schizophrenia service at Johns Hopkins, and we proceeded to implant the electrodes. They're very, very tiny leads to the substantia nigra pars reticulata. The interesting things that also made us choose that area is that, let's say, the path from the cortex, which is the frontal lobes, down to the substantia nigra is a path that has been traveled so many times by our neurosurgeons at Hopkins, because the area for treatment or delivering the stimulus for treatment of Parkinson's disease is a few millimeters above. So there was lots of experience and expertise in reaching that part of the brain. So once we implanted the leads, We waited a week, and after that week, we implanted under the clavicle of the patient the stimulator, the pulse generator called IPG. Once we did that, we waited a month before we started the stimulation. We want to avoid any placebo effects, any lesion effects due to the entry of the leads into the brain.
Mm-hmm. So you were very careful, certainly.
Absolutely.
Yes. Now, you placed the leads on either side of the substantia nigra, and I noted in your study you talked about the bilateral stimulation. Now, when you delivered the electricity, were you giving some to the right side first, and then to the left, and then to the right, and then to the left, or was it delivered at the same time to both sides?
No, we did, as you said the first time, separately. So on the day when we started the stimulation, which was March the 2nd, 2020, we did program, essentially, the stimulator. And so we delivered the current to the right and later to the left. And so on both sides, of course, we did, in that case, you know, observe, you know, the reaction of the patient in terms of the symptoms that she was reporting to us.
And following all the treatment then, what happened to her hallucinations?
Yes, I would say to somehow our surprise, but, you know, the reaction was favorable to start with. During the programming session, we were able to deliver a very small current, 0.8 volt to the right and one to the left, with the immediate resolution of the auditory hallucination. Unknown to the patient, we turned off the stimulation, and according to the patient herself, she did report a recurrence of the hallucinations.
So then you were able to find the sort of sweet spot for the amount of current that was necessary to wipe out her hallucinations, at least during
yes,
the test.
Absolutely. And those were the parameters that we left the patient on.
And what happened to the patient's delusional suspicions after your treatment?
Those took a little bit longer to disappear. After several weeks, I would say, those delusions with persecutory content really disappeared, went down to a score of 1 on the scale that we used for the assessment of the psychopathology, and I would say that never returned to a previous level, and they stayed down at that score of 1. I have to add that there was a few months after the onset of the stimulation, in conjunction with some stressful life event of the patient, she had a return of the hallucinations, although it was not as severe as the ones that she had before the stimulation was started, but indeed was like a single episode, single event, limited to one day. And after that, she's been symptom-free up to more than a year now. Of course, we are still following the patient, and she's symptom-free.
We've been talking with Dr. Nicola Cascella, Assistant Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Great news about the results with your patient. Did she suffer any complications or side effects from the treatment?
There were no complications from the neurosurgery, which is very important, of course, as well as from the implant of the IPG. I think this is also due to the fact that the age of this population is much younger than a patient with Parkinson who gets implanted with this type of system, and where the morbidity and possible mortality is higher. She did, we have to say this, as we report in our correspondence to the journal Biological Psychiatry, she gained weight after we started the stimulation. She gained about 20 pounds, which is significant, of course, and we cannot discount that. But that weight stabilized, and she started to lose whatever she had gained. So it's possible that because, you know, maybe the area that we stimulate has an effect on what we call limbic system, or maybe the system that regulates food intake, that was affected by our modulation. She did indeed say that she had some sort of craving for sweets after the stimulation. And it's possible that we did cause sort of modulation of those brain areas.
Doctor, I want to move away from this particular patient and just talk about schizophrenia for a moment. I understand the condition ordinarily begins in late adolescence. Now, what advice would you give to our parents who are listening out there who might not be sure if their teenager may be suffering an onset of schizophrenia? Are there telltale signs that the average parent should look for to differentiate between, like, schizophrenia and the normal challenges of teen years?
I think that one of the most important tell signs is actually two things. One is social withdrawal, which happens even a year or two or even longer sometimes before the onset of what we call positive symptoms, hallucinations and delusions. And this is, you know, sometimes out of character of the patient. And then the other thing is also another sign, I would say, is cognitive decline, which has to do with declining academic performance in school. So those are two things that could raise the suspicions of the parents, for example, along with changes in mood, sometimes so-called depression. That could be the first sign, but then later on the patient goes on to develop positive symptoms. Of course, if, you know, there is an acute onset of positive symptoms, including bizarre behavior, as well as, you know, disorganized behaviors, of course, parents should be able to tell that those, of course, are abnormal behavior not seen before in their daughter or son, and of course, take the patient or the person to see a psychiatrist.
All helpful advice. Dr. Nicola Cascella, Assistant Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and faculty member at the Johns Hopkins Schizophrenia Center. I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Up next, a look at a futuristic heart pump that may be a lifeline for end-stage heart failure patients. Mayo Clinic Q&A is next on MedClinic Radio.
You're listening to MedClinic Radio, exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
Now, on this week's Mayo Clinic Q&A segment, an important look at an innovative device to help heart failure patients. Here's Dr. Helena Gazelka.
Did you ever watch some of the futuristic cartoons or TV shows decades ago? Our topic today may sound like something from science or the future, but amazingly, it is a reality today. A ventricular assist device, also known as a VAD, is an implantable mechanical pump that helps pump blood from the lower chambers of your heart or the ventricles to the rest of your body. A VAD is used in people who have weakened hearts or heart failure. A VAD may be implanted while the patient waits for a heart transplant or is working to get their own heart strong enough to effectively pump blood on its own. Well, we have an expert with us to discuss this today. Dr. John Stulak is a cardiovascular surgeon at Mayo Clinic, and he's going to help us understand ventricular assist devices. John, what in the world does this device look like?
Yeah, it's about the size of a hockey puck. So it's kind of a maybe 3 inches in diameter. And it has a cannula, which is kind of a pipe that gets implanted into the failing ventricle, as you indicate it. And then it's fastened to the heart. And then we hook it up to the main blood vessel of the heart called the aorta. And patients do have a power cord that exits the body and they get hooked up to a power source. And it's implantable. They live with this device, like you said, either as a bridge to transplant or as what we call destination therapy. I think we'll talk a little bit about both of those in a little bit. But it's a pump that stays in there. The heart stays inside the body. And just as the name denotes, a ventricular assist device, it assists the heart in delivering blood flow to the rest of the body in patients with heart failure. So like you said, a little science fiction, but certainly a reality for about 20 years now.
But basically augments what the heart can do, so it makes it pump harder. Would that be correct?
Well, the native heart stays present, and it can either improve or pump poorly. But the ventricular assist device really doesn't depend on the left side of the heart for pumping at all. However, you make a very good point in that the patient still has a right ventricle. We all have four chambers of the heart. So we do need a lot of the medical therapy in these patients is geared at maintaining that right ventricular function so that blood can be delivered to the LVAD on the left side of the heart, and then it gets pumped to the body. So it does assist the left side of the heart.
John, how many institutions or places in the United States implant these devices?
It's a growing number. Initially, when the therapy was beginning to be adopted, you had to be, and CMS required, for implanting centers to be tied to a transplant program. Mm-hmm. But now, since the growing population really in whom we implant these are what we call destination therapy, it's for patients who will live with this device for the rest of their lives. Institutions that implant these do not need to be a transplant center. So we're seeing more and more centers offer this therapy. And so the number is growing toward 200, 250. And
oh, wow.
New centers are being added all the time across this country, certainly around the world.
So you mentioned intriguing words there, destination therapy versus patients waiting for transplant. Tell us a little about that.
The initial use of this therapy was for patients with very bad heart failure to implant the pump. And this was in earlier generations where it may not have been as durable, et cetera, and to get the patient, a very sick patient, as a bridge to a transplant. So like I said, we implant the LVAD. It helps deliver blood flow to the body. So, you know, it keeps the liver and the kidneys and the lungs alive, and the patient can get up and live with it, go home while they wait for a heart transplant, because there's a limitation of donor organs. And sometimes patients are waiting for a year, two, three for a heart transplant, a donor organ. And so at that point, we implanted the pump with the expectation that they were going to get bridged and have it removed, you know, at the time of heart transplantation. More recently, with the advances in how good the pump is, and we can talk about that a little bit too, there's been major technological advances. These pumps are now very compatible with the blood in the body, such that patients are living with these. And so now you could be older than a transplant candidate. Typically around the age of 65 is where we consider patients not to be transplant candidates because of their age. And they live with this device for the rest of their lives. And we wholly expect, and we follow about 100 patients here at Mayo Clinic, in whom patients have these as destination therapy. So they go to the market, they get back to farming, they get back to living life, you know,
wow,
with the device. So pretty
amazing.
How
long can you live with one, John?
Well, the program here started in earnest in 2007, and we have a couple patients from those early days, 2008. We have someone 13 years living on the device. So we're now in the third generation of pumps. All that really means is there's been just several technological advances through time, such that really device failure and mechanical durability are really at a point where we do not see device failure anymore. But from a mechanical perspective, we are just not seeing pumps wear out these days. So from a medical standpoint, if we can optimize everything, patients can live a very, very long time. I know some institutions are having people that are approaching 17 and 18 years on a device.
Wow, that is amazing. How do you know if someone needs a ventricular assist device, and how are they assessed for that?
Oh, this is a great question. And I think this really gets at the crux of, you know, when do we really consider a patient for this therapy? And heart failure can be, you know, a very ongoing chronic disease that patients live with and can be maintained on medications for a very long time. However, the natural history of this is that patients live for years and years with heart failure, but with a slow decline in heart function and condition. So it's really when patients get to this point where we call advanced heart failure. This is where the patients have very limiting symptoms with very little activity. And it's really to the point where they're having a failure of medical management. And so once medicines fail, it's very exciting to say, like, wow, we have an option, you know, a surgical option for your heart failure, whether it's not it's destination therapy for the majority of these patients as they age. So it's really when patients get to that point of advanced heart failure, when medications are failing, and they have significant symptoms with very little activity.
Can you take these pumps out later?
We can, yeah. There is a very small percentage of patients and certain diagnoses like myocarditis, which is inflammation of the heart muscle, or several other entities where we put the pump in, it allows the heart muscle, since the pump is pumping the blood, it allows the heart muscle to rest. And we do see recovery in patients. However, it's very low percentage of patients. About 1 to 2% of all the implants in the country really show signs of recovery. but we have recovered patients and then removed the device.
Up next, as our Mayo Clinic Q&A segment continues, we'll learn the risks of a ventricular assist device and what life can be like after the device is implanted. MedClinic Radio continues in a moment.
Welcome back to MedClinic Radio. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
Now we continue with our Mayo Clinic Q&A segment as we look at the ventricular assist device, also known as VAD, an implantable mechanical pump that helps pump blood from the lower chambers of your heart, or ventricles, to the rest of your body. Once again, here's Dr. Helena Gazelka.
So tell me a little bit more about the different types of pumps that there are.
Sure. I alluded to this. We've gone through several kind of technological advances, and it really kind of gets down into the weeds of the engineering. The first generation were what we called pulsatile pumps. So it had a pumping mechanism and the patient still had a pulse. However, there was a lot of moving parts and the durability of those pumps. You can imagine if you had to have a machine kind of beating against itself constantly, it wore out. And so those pumps were only lasting about 9 to 12 months. Then we got into the second generation pumps, and that was more that had sort of like an impeller, like a boat, kind of a boat impeller, if you will, which spun the blood through the pump. And that was a good pump, and that served us for about 10 to 15 years or so. But the problem with that is you can imagine a boat engine with the impeller is it generated a lot of heat. And so that was very rough on the blood products and caused a lot of blood clotting. Now we're at a point which is called centrifugal flow, but we're able to magnetically levitate these impellers so there's no touching parts. The blood comes in and a motor shoots the blood out to the aorta like I described without any parts or metal or anything touching each other. So it's very, very gentle on the blood itself. It causes very few blood clots or strokes or bleeding problems like the older pumps did. So that's where we are now, the third generation pumps.
How interesting. Now, you mentioned that people go back home after having these put in or back to other activities. What would one see outside of their body and what sort of a power source is connected?
Everything, the pump and everything is on the inside. However, patients do have an electrical cord looking device that does exit the body, and they have to wear a vest, and some patients accessorize. They'll get a fishing jacket and actually there's several companies that actually make clothing and accessories, you know, for LVAD patients. You know, they have certain pockets for their batteries, kind of like a Batman belt or something. And some patients, you know, they accessorize and they have fun with it. You know, they kind of embrace the technology and they embrace the fact that these pumps are helping them live years and years beyond what they otherwise would have, you know, if they wouldn't have had the pump. But to look at a patient, quite honestly, you know, from the outside with a certain, you know, clothing and jackets, you may not even see that mention of it. And so you may not even know. But to look at a patient, you know, in the office setting, you can see that they have a power cord coming out and they're hooked up to either batteries or kind of a wall power unit.
Oh, very interesting. So what are the risks of having this implanted and of living with it?
This is very intensive therapy. It's a great question because patients really do need to know it's very intensive therapy. But the outcomes, you know, for us from a surgical standpoint, the risks of having the pump implanted really are getting very, very less to the point where, you know, the surgical risk of having this implanted really is mirroring that of a valve replacement or coronary bypass operation in appropriate patients. So we're really, you know, with advances in anesthesia care, intensive care, et cetera, we're really getting the initial risks down, you know, almost to that of regular heart surgery. Now, in the ongoing phase, there is an ongoing risk because patients need to take blood thinners while they're on it. So a lot of the risk that patients have really depends on, you know, them taking the blood thinner. So if their blood gets too thin with the blood thinner, they could have bleeding. And we see GI bleeding with patients mainly, or if we have to stop the blood thinner for some reason, et cetera, patients can develop clots in the pump. And then you can have things called thrombosis or getting clot in the pump. So it's not working very well, or you can have things like a stroke. Those are risks. And probably what I would say is the Achilles heel of VAD therapy really is that power cord. That is the interface between the outside dirty world and the inside sterile world.
Oh, sure.
So we do see about one third of patients have an infection at that drive line. But really anything you put in your body, like artificial hip, artificial knee, a mesh for hernia repair, et cetera. Whenever you have something foreign interacting with the body, there's a chance of infection. But these patients are maintained on antibiotics and they do undergo very, very strict follow-up after implant.
And John, you mentioned that there are older pumps now and then newer pumps being developed. Can you go in and change out the type of VAD that someone has as new technology becomes available? And do you ever have to change the battery packs?
Yeah, and we've had to do that. Let's just say a patient's had the older second generation pump and it's either gotten infected or clotted. We have changed pump styles because if we have to go in and change the pump, we'll say, hey, let's upgrade them to a newer technology. However, you know, with all the patients that we're following out there, those second generation pumps were still very good pumps. So if the pump is working, then, you know, sometimes you don't want to poke a skunk, so to speak. And, sure. You know, the patients just get maintained on their therapy. And like I said, some of those that are living since 2008 have those second generation pumps. So those are still very durable pumps. But we have done the change from second to third generation pumps as needed.
And the batteries are all external, correct?
They are. Those are all okay. The external. So if we were to change pump style, we would just change the controller that they have, which, you know, kind of measures the flow and everything. And we would change all the externals, like the batteries and the power hookups.
How often do patients have to follow up after they have a pump?
You know, it's ongoing therapy. And here for the first 6 to 12 months, we have them come back every 2 months. We do partner with a lot of institutions out there in the community. And so we do what's called shared care. So we do try to save patients a travel back to Rochester because sometimes patients travel quite a distance. So we have this very big kind of collaborative network out there, and more hospitals are becoming comfortable with treating these patients. 10 years ago, they were these complex patients. You know, no one, you know, I think you're, you know, we're afraid of the uncertainty of right. things in life, I think, but people have embraced it and they realize that there's a lot of patients living in their communities with these LVADs. And so it's very exciting. We partner with upwards of 20 institutions around kind of the upper Midwest area to save the patient that travel back and forth. So it's things like echocardiograms to get a picture, make sure the heart is looking good, laboratory values, and then just office visits to see, you know, are their symptoms better? Do we need to change the speed of the pump? And ongoing issues. We'll look at the driveline site, make sure there's no infection, et cetera. So it's really a pretty detailed assessment that we do at those office visits.
Are you using any virtual visits? We're using so many more virtual visits in some areas of Mayo. Now I'm wondering if you are able to do that.
Yeah, we do that a lot. Our LVAD coordinators and LVAD program, you know, we have an emergency line, which is a cell phone, and they can call 24/7. But if we need to, you know, if need be, then yeah, we can hop on Skype, or the telemedicine really has improved our reach to really almost see patients at the drop of a hat if they need it. So yeah, I think we're embracing all aspects of technology to kind of help this other technology be better ongoing for the patients.
This sounds just incredible to me, John. And I think one of the things that I have noted the most practicing palliative medicine is how profoundly symptomatic and how miserable people really can be when they have significant heart failure. And I'm wondering, what do you see in terms of symptom improvement? Can it be fairly profound in individuals who have a ventricular assist device placed?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you're talking about a patient with end-stage heart failure who may be out of breath brushing their teeth. They're out of breath sitting, you know, in the recliner watching TV. You know, when the patient really ends up having symptoms at rest, that's the telltale sign that this is end-stage heart failure. And really, in many instances, the patient will hardly live 6 to 12 months when they get that dense degree of heart failure symptoms. And then what the LVAD does is it helps that left side of the heart pump and kind of decongests the heart and gets all the blood moving forward again. And then we get patients that get back to basically doing everything they want to do. They may still have some symptoms, you know, just because they've been so sick and deconditioned for some time. But we've had some patients, I mean, literally, you know, some of the farmers here in the upper Midwest, you know, they'll be very symptomatic, get an LVAD, and they will literally be back to farming in a couple of months. And so it's really neat to see patients get back to doing what they want to do.
And I think one of the things that our listeners may not recognize is that how profoundly your other organs suffer when your heart can't. I mean, we think of heart failure as being a heart problem, but really it's a whole body problem.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, blood is what carries the nutrients, the oxygen. And, you know, patients with chronic heart failure, they can see dysfunction in a lot of different areas. They may become cognitively, you know, cloudy, so to speak. If the brain's not getting blood flow, we see that cognitive dysfunction. We see certainly the kidneys start to fail. We've even had some patients progress to needing dialysis because the, you know, because the heart is not providing enough oxygen and blood flow. Then other things like the liver, the intestines, you know, patients may have, you know, stomach cramps or get, you know, have trouble with digestion, et cetera. But certainly, you know, muscle cramps, they just, yeah, if the blood is not getting to the tissues, it's a, like you said, it's a whole body problem.
This is really a fascinating topic. What advice would you give individuals who may have heart failure or know those who suffer from it, have friends or family, and wonder whether this is a type of therapy they should be talking to their physician about?
One of the biggest things is that this therapy is really underutilized therapy. It's really underused. When if you look at the hundreds of thousands of people suffering from advanced heart failure and heart disease, a very large percentage of these patients are candidates for LVAD. And I think that there's either hesitancy or really a lack of awareness, like you say, about when should patients be referred. So I think the general framework is that if you're having significant symptoms with medical therapy and you feel like the medical therapy is failing, you are a candidate for this. Patients are now extending into that from chronic heart failure to advanced heart failure. And it's very exciting that we have a surgical treatment for this now.
That is really exciting. And obviously, this is a therapy that is offered in centers where these are performed regularly. It's obviously something highly specialized that people would want to go to a center where they were done frequently, I imagine.
Yeah, that's right. I think just like whether it's congenital heart surgery, certain types of valve operations, et cetera, really the outcomes of this procedure is very closely tied to the volume of patients. So you certainly, I think patients want to get to a well-connected kind of high volume center that really has the infrastructure to offer really not only round the clock care, but really complete care in terms of, you know, other organ systems, or like I said, it's very intensive therapy with potential complications. So you really want to think about a center that can offer one-stop shopping, so to speak. If there's a takeaway also, it's that if a patient or a referring provider is thinking about referring the patients, we would rather see the patients earlier rather than later, because we've certainly been in a situation where we get patients who are a little bit too far progressed. So the kidneys have shut down, or now they're in liver failure, et cetera. So there is a sweet spot to when we get referral to this. So we would rather establish the relationship and see a patient far earlier, follow them along until the appropriate time. It's not that we're just going to push an LVAD on everybody, but we'd rather know about the patients and establish that, you know, care pathway early on rather than get the patient too late. Because we have had that happen as well, where patients are not a candidate when they're too sick.
And so helpful to be able to weigh the options as patients are moving through this disease trajectory too.
Oh, difficult. Absolutely. And you hit the nail on the head. We really look at this from a holistic viewpoint. We do have the meet with our colleagues from palliative care medicine, you know, to discuss, you know, what are your goals? What would you take on in terms of how intensive therapy is? And some patients say, you know, I'm just going to go along with medical therapy, and this isn't a therapy for me. And so we do help patients navigate those very complex issues.
Thanks so much for being here today, John.
This is absolutely my pleasure, Dr. Gazelka. Thank you again for the invitation.
Our thanks to Dr. John Stulak, cardiovascular surgeon at Mayo Clinic, for helping us to understand ventricular assist devices for heart failure.
Mayo Clinic Q&A is a production of the Mayo Clinic News Network and is available wherever you find your favorite podcasts. To see a list of all Mayo Clinic podcasts, visit newsnetwork.mayoclinic.org and then click on Podcasts. And that wraps up this week's Med Clinic Radio, produced by Syndication Networks of Chicago. Our executive producer is Randy Meyer, and I'm your host, Gina Tedesco. Thanks for joining us, and we hope to catch you again next week for another edition of Med Clinic Radio.
Syndication Network.